Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we first hear from Jill Stein about her effort to get the Green Party line for president here in New York. Then our peace segment focuses on a student rally to get state officials to support a ceasefire in Gaza. After that, we listen in on the experience of viewing the eclipse in totality. And finally, we finish this with a segment about Beethoven live in concert, an original rock musical about Ludwig van Beethoven. But first, headlines.
Republicans are challenging the petitions submitted by Democrat Josh Ryan to get the Working Family Party's line in his rematch against Congressman Mark Molinaro. The 19th congressional district now includes the southern part of Rensselaer County.
A recent house fire on Morris Street in the city of Albany is highlighting the problem of affordable housing, as nearly two dozen migrants are homeless after cramming into the single-family home that was destroyed.
The City of Albany's annual Tulip Festival will take place on May 7th. City officials hope that the warm weather won't disrupt the blooming of the quarter million tulip bulbs they planted.
A Schenectady man has been charged with starving his five-year-old daughter to death after allegedly not feeding her for 5 days. A second, younger child tested positive for cocaine.
A long-running legal fight over New York requiring employees to include abortion coverage in their workers' health insurance plans was heard by the state's highest court on Tuesday.
An Albany police officer was shot and wounded, and the suspect was killed early Wednesday morning after a traffic stop in the Pine Hills neighborhood just after midnight.
Craig N. Ross Jr., who kidnapped and assaulted a young girl in Moreau Lake State Park last summer, was sentenced to 47 years to life in prison.
The Daily Gazette reports that after more than a year of negotiating, more than 100 nurses from Ellis Hospital rallied Tuesday in Schenectady to demand a fairer contract and raise awareness how the low morale and high turnover rates that some say are symptoms of corporate greed that threaten to imperil the health of Schenectady residents. And that's it for headlines.
So Governor Hochul on Monday announced a conceptual agreement on a state budget, though the two legislative leaders did not join in her pronouncement. So, Mark, where are we right now? Did we get a budget or not?
We did not get a budget. We got some spin work from the governor, trying to get some good headlines and trying to get the media to stop saying we have a late budget. But in reality, there was no budget agreement. They may be close, but a budget is $250 billion. And so you may agree on 10 points, but you got 100 other points you got to get agreement on. Then the other problem they got is apparently last night somebody hacked into the bill drafting system, and so they can't finish writing the bills, and then they have to print the bills before the legislature votes on them. Actually, it would be nice if the legislators got the bills and could read them before they voted upon them, but that usually doesn't happen. But you actually do have to have the bills printed, and right now they can't even get the bills drafted.
So you mentioned agreeing to bills. Are there parts in the budget that have been agreed to?
Maybe. Certainly the one that everybody is talking about, and the governor is mainly claiming victory on, is on the issue of affordable housing. Though I think a lot of people are kind of skeptical that even if the deal does go through, as the governor has proposed, unclear whether it actually will produce affordable housing. What is interesting is both the real estate industry and the tenants are very unhappy with the deal. The tenant groups, in fact, are urging the legislature to vote against the bill. The one that seems happiest are the unions. They were trying to push for a minimum wage of $40 an hour for people in the construction industry. A lot of them would be non-unions because you get a lot of immigrants working statewide, but particularly in the city. So they seemed the happiest. You know, good cause eviction was the thing that the tenants were demanding in exchange for continuing to provide tax breaks for luxury housing. According to the tenant activists, the good cause law was really gutted. Some provisions like it would not apply to any housing that's been built in the last 30 years. Instead of limiting rent hikes to 5%, it would be 5% plus inflation, up to 10% maximum. And it doesn't seem, it seems like they're only enacting good cause eviction in New York City, which is the place that least needs it, because New York City already has rent control. Basically, it would be left up to local governments to decide whether or not to opt in. You'd assume the city of Albany, which is the first one to pass good cause eviction, would jump on that opportunity. But how you would fare in Troy, for instance, where the majority of the city council is Republicans, you know, that's, you know, quite a bit up in the air. The governor did lose on the issue of basically over the last 10, 15 years, the courts have ordered the state to increase funding for school aid, particularly for rural communities and then inner city low income communities, because they have been unfunded. And during that transition, the compromise was that no school district would lose existing funding. Everybody would have to either see the stay the same or be increased. And that was called hold harmless. Now, over the last 10 to 15 years, many school districts, including in rural areas, have seen a dramatic decline in their number of students. And so their level of school funding no longer really corresponds to what school aid should be. And the governor was trying to rectify that in this year's budget. Actually, it would impact about half the schools in the state. That was blocked. Instead, they're going to take another year to study the issue. Or in other words, let's kick the can down the road and let's fight it next year in a non-election year. You know, there's certainly a lot of other things that were done. The governor sought to cut in half the $500 million it was agreed to a number of years ago to invest in water infrastructure, a big issue for City of Troy and elsewhere. That looks like that money was restored in the budget. One of the big fights, something called Tier 6, and mainly the newer public employees' pension was a little bit different calculation than existing state and local government workers. So they had some deal on that, not quite clear. They wanted to look at five-year average rather than, I'm sorry, they're looking at five-year average, last, you know, highest pay for the last 5 years. They were trying to push 3 years, which of course historically been particularly abused by the police, who run up massive overtime in their last few years in order to drive up their pension. They made some type of compromise on that one.
So what are some of the issues that are far from an agreement? What are still outstanding?
Well, one or two, I mean, certainly the climate issue has not been resolved. We've had a lot of discussion with so-called New York Heat Act, and there were sort of three components on that. And it seemed like pretty much they agreed on two of them, particularly what's known as the 100-foot rule to cut down on subsidies to new gas infrastructure pipeline expansion. And what they were fighting over was whether or not to cap the bills for low-income people at 6% of income. And it seems like now the entire thing's out of the budget. Now, the Assembly always wants, they argue, things that are more policy-related to be taken out of the budget. But there was a big pushback from some of the utility companies, particularly out in the western part of the state, and by some of the unions. The unions, you know, they like building gas pipelines because they're good construction paying jobs. So it seems like the legislature may have caved on this. It would be a massive loss for the climate movement. We were told it's not in the budget, but since the budget's not done, it's not printed, people are fighting very hard today and tomorrow until the budget is passed to try to get that in. The other one which seems to be out is the idea about a climate superfund, which is to get the largest greenhouse emitters, polluters, to pay up to $3 billion collectively a year for the next 30 years in order to mitigate some of the damages that have been caused by air pollution. And at the moment, that does not appear, you know, to be in the budget. But there are so many, you know, issues that, you know, the governor may not talk about, but legislators do. And when you're, you know, talking about $250 million, that $10 million here or $5 million there, that's still very critical. It had seemed like the legislature was moving to fund universal school meals. That was in, I believe, both One House budgets, but sort of indicates that that's not there. But until a budget is actually printed, you don't actually know what's in the budget. And, you know, legislators really don't know what's in the budget. And on Monday, when they were negotiating or passing the budget extender through tomorrow, through Thursday, people at the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, when asked, well, we heard the governor just said we have a budget deal. And she said, that's news to me. So there's still a lot of issues outstanding. Obviously, they're trying to close it down. But if they don't get it passed tomorrow, which seems unlikely because they can't get bill drafting and they can't get a bill in front of the legislators, then it goes for another weekend and things can reopen. And, you know, it ain't done till it's done, as Yogi used to say.
Sounds like there's still a lot of work to be done. Thank you, Mark, for that update on getting closer to that state budget. And next up, we have Jill Stein, who's seeking the Green Party nod against again as a run for president. She held a press conference at the state capitol on Tuesday to launch the petition to drive her campaign here in New York.
On Tuesday, April 16th, Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein was at the state capitol in Albany to launch the effort to collect the 45,000 signatures needed in the next 6 weeks to get the Green Party on the ballot in New York for the general election. Dr. Stein also talks about issues such as single-payer health care, the climate crisis, the ongoing genocide in Gaza, and income inequality.
As you know, it's no simple matter for independent and third-party candidates to get on the ballot, to actually be a choice for the voters of New York State. The ballot requirement that was incredibly ratcheted up in 2020 from 15,000 signatures over a very short period relative to other states, 6 weeks, that was tripled from 15,000 to 45,000 signatures that are required now in 6 weeks, making New York probably the most difficult state for alternative candidates to get on the ballot. And why does that matter? Well, you know, in the current environment where the two major party candidates are historically unpopular and widely rejected, New Yorkers, like the rest of Americans, are hungry for other choices and other voices, and for candidates who reflect the deeply felt needs and wishes of New Yorkers. For example, healthcare as a human right, which is supported by an overwhelming majority of the population, hasn't been passed in New York and all other states, even when there is a Democratic Party trifecta in the governor's office and in both houses of the legislature. And that doesn't pass the healthcare needs of the American people are in very sore shape, with something like 70,000 deaths per year, one out of every three COVID deaths linked to lack of health insurance, some 87 million Americans who do not have adequate healthcare coverage, who are choosing between their rent and their pharmaceuticals and so on. It's about time that we have a candidate on the ballot who actually is committed to a single-payer type Medicare for all system, which not only provides healthcare head to toe, cradle to grave, actually conception to grave, and which saves approximately half a trillion dollars per year, even after healthcare has been expanded to everyone. And there are just a whole slew of critical issues now. Half of renters who are struggling, and that's a national figure, half of renters who are technically severely economically stressed, trying to keep a roof over their heads, and of course it's actually much worse in New York State, that problem is going unsolved. Our endless wars and the endless war machine that consumes half of our national budget, half of the congressional budget, is being spent basically on the Pentagon and related departments, consuming half of our discretionary resources, while we do not have the money to get students out of debt, to provide public higher education for free, which it should be, to ensure that the needs, the critical needs for housing and healthcare and education and so on, are being met. We are spending inordinate amounts of money, currently looking at an additional, I think it's $69 billion for Ukraine, if I'm not mistaken, and $14 billion for the genocidal war in the Middle East, which is perhaps about to expand in an extremely dangerous way. So these are very serious concerns of the American people. Not only do they need to be debated in this election, if they can't be debated in an election, when can they be? And voters deserve a right to actually choose candidates that represent their views on these issues. And the issues I enumerated have enormous, enormous, and usually majoritarian popular support as well. In fighting for democracy on the ballot drive, we are fighting a system which is essentially structured to keep competition out. And I want to note also that the Democrats have resorted to shameless scheming to keep their competition off the ballot. And an example of that was our Green Party Senate candidate in 2022, Matthew Ho, which is worth noting because there were dirty tricks launched against him, led by the notorious Mark Elias, who is the attorney heading up the DNC's Department of Dirty Tricks. And it is public knowledge that the DNC has hired on, according to their own announcement, an army of lawyers in order to try to nitpick their opposition on trivial, minor technical details to be able to throw us off the ballot and also to circulate rumors and smear campaigns to try to challenge our integrity. In North Carolina, in the Senate race in 2022, where our Senate candidate, Matthew Ho, who was a noted State Department diplomat, actually, in Afghanistan, and who very publicly quit during Obama's surge into Afghanistan, and we know how that went. He was running for Senate, and Mark Elias and his dirty tricksters impersonated the Green Party and phone called people who had signed our petition, Matt Ho's petition, pretending to be members of the Green Party. And the reason we know this, the impersonators happened to call the co-chair of the Green Party, who had the presence of mind to actually record that conversation, which is in the public domain now and was presented in court subsequently and led to the legal determination that the Democrats were basically operating with so-called dirty hands, which is a legal term, and they were fined for that. What is wrong with our political system today in which basically big money is buying influence regularly and competitors are being thrown off the ballot? So this is a real problem for democracy. And that is why we are launching our ballot drive here along with this fight for democracy, really calling for the rules of ballot access in New York State to be rolled back to 15,000 rather than 45,000. We actually did challenge this in court, and the court was not interested, unfortunately. And I want to just add that currently our campaign is the front runner among the Green Party candidates for the nomination. We are basically achieving 90% of the delegate votes at this point. We are heading right now for 21 current ballot lines that we collectively as the Green Parties and our campaign already have, and that includes the other most difficult states, that is California, Texas, and Florida, also Arizona. Those are already behind us, so we are well on the way. We are said to have 75% actually of the work done. It's in total 1 million signatures approximately that are needed in order to run as an independent or a third party. So we have about 75% of that work done. We are, as I mentioned, we have access in 21 states, including the most difficult. We're petitioning in another 25 states now. Those will be turned in over the next couple of weeks. Basically, we are on track to be the only pro-worker, anti-genocide, climate emergency choice that will be on the ballot for voters across the nation. There are other people-powered campaigns, I should mention, that are running with a very similar agenda, but they do not have the ability, the resources, the track record, the staff, et cetera, to be on the ballot as a true force to contest for power. And that is why this fight in New York State matters, not just, you know, for our overall democracy and for the sake of actual debate in this election, but for the sake of voters who are chomping at the bit.
Do you feel like Democrats and Republicans, Biden and Trump, are kind of equivalent in how they've disappointed, as you would say, the American people?
They are not the same, in my view. They are different, especially around the margins. But I personally, like many Americans, am hard-pressed to tell you which one is the greater and which one is the lesser evil when Joe Biden is leading us in a genocidal war, in the expansion of wars on many fronts, extremely now teetering at the nuclear brink, and where the Democrats are likewise leading the assault on our freedom of speech. We have an emergency here. We have an emergency for our climate, for our economy, for the state of crushing inequality, for endless wars which are now verging on nuclear. We have a state of emergency, and the American people are not going to just sit back and be told to be good little boys and girls and either vote for more of the same that has delivered this crisis by both Democrats and Republicans, or to simply sit it out and silence yourself. Silence is not a political strategy.
This has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And I should disclose I've been involved with Jill Stein's prior campaigns. She was in Albany on Tuesday at the state capitol to announce the kickoff of the petition drive to get the Green Party on the ballot here in New York.
For this week's Peace segment, we focus on Gaza. The first reports on a student rally at the Capitol calling for state officials, including the Sunni administration, to support a ceasefire and to halt business with Israel. The second half focuses on Fred Nagel's activist report.
This week's Peace Bucket on Hudson Mohawk Magazine is divided into two sections. The first half reports on a rally organized by college students at the state capitol on Monday, April 15th, to call on the Sunni administration, the governor, and state lawmakers, and controller Tom DiNapoli to halt doing business and investing in Israel, at least until they stop the genocide in Gaza. The rally of several hundred people marched from the state capitol down to Sunni Central Administration. We hear from Samara Sangari with Black Lives Matter from Saratoga, Adrian Antonioli from Skidmore College, Peter Lavinia, a Sunni professor and co-chair of the Green Party of New York State, and Iyad Al-Karabi of the Queer Palestinian Empowerment Network. In the second half, we hear from Fred Nagel as part of his weekly activist radio segment from the Vassar College radio station.
Samara Sangari, she's a poet, a human rights scholar with a BA in Holocaust Genocide Studies, and a co-founder of Saratoga Black Lives Matter.
Call and response right now. How much talk today, and I come here because I always talk about the struggles and the interconnectedness of our fights and our movement.
Yes!
That Palestinians, just like indigenous peoples, just like Black Americans in America, have fought against the chains and oppression of tyranny, just like Palestinians. It is simple as to why our fights are interconnected. Just like the Black Panther Party, who got messages, Angela Davis got letters from Palestinians talking about how they support her, how they fight for her, all the way in Palestine.
I hope and I pray, and we are here to see that this work that we've been doing in the past months materializes in a free, liberated, and independent Palestine. I'm a student organizer with Skidmore for Palestine, and we have spent the past 6 months demanding that Skidmore cut ties with Israel, whatever they may be. All of Skidmore's runs on HP, a company that is actively providing the necessary technology, additionally has a professorial exchange program with Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, a school which has stolen the water from indigenous Bedouin Palestinians and is intimately linked to the colonization of southern Palestine and the maintenance and occupation of the Gaza death camp. What more I can say about Skidmore's complicity in genocide, about Skidmore's role in maintaining this false sense that if only we have enough dialogues, we can get through this. But we know that there is no dialogue to be had between the sword and the neck. There is only an intifada, there is only revolution, there is only boycott, divestments, and sanctions that can take down the occupation, that can put an end to the genocide, and that can free Palestine. I want to focus on the solidarity that I see here today. For our struggle at Skidmore to be successful, we need SUNY BDS to be successful. In our schools, in our isolated workplaces, in our own personal shopping habits, no one will hear, no one will listen, and no one will act. Instead, we must act collectively and connect and activate on all of our campuses. For a future where universities in Gaza are rebuilt, and that the history, the intelligence, and the creativity of Palestine and the Palestinian people will finally be free.
Free, free, free Palestine!
Free, free, free Palestine!
Yeah, my name's Peter Lavinia. I'm the co-chair of the Green Party of New York State. I'm also a professor at SUNY Oneonta. And I'm here to support the Palestinian rights and to protest with SUNY BDS.
And so what's the call for divestment? What's the focus of today?
The focus is to divest from stocks and other parts of the SUNY fund that are invested in military stocks that fund Israel or weapons that are attacking Gaza.
And what's the Green Party's position on this whole situation?
We support Gaza and we support Palestinian liberation. You know, we support a Palestinian state in the Middle East, and we call for an end to the genocide that's happening in Gaza and a permanent ceasefire.
And what should SUNY and the state controller and the rest of them do? And the governor?
They should divest, and they should call for a ceasefire. It's an unconscionable moral crime what's happening in Gaza right now, and every instant that our elected leaders don't stand up for what's right, it's a moral failing. You know, the comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, should stand up and say we're divesting from this, just like he should from stocks that invest in fossil fuel companies. And unfortunately, Tom DiNapoli has gotten away with it for too long and hasn't. But we need to put pressure on him, Kathy Hochul, and the legislature to do so.
Hi, so my name is Iyad. My affiliation is with QPEN, which is the LGBT Palestinian group nationally, locally the Palestinian Rights Committee, and as a SUNY alumni supportive of Palestinians organizing stuff.
And what was the message today?
To get SUNY to invest in human rights and divest from the state of Israel and divest from the war economy.
And have you had any response so far from SUNY?
Not really. I did try to let them know before we send the protest, come meet with us and do this anyway, but I guess we're going to have to.
Next is Fred Nagel of Activist Radio at Vassar College Radio Station.
Our first story is from Middle East Eye. A group of graduate students at Yale University launched a hunger strike on Friday in protest against the institution's investments in companies providing Israel with military weaponry. Students argue the university is profiting off what a growing number of Americans say is a genocide of Palestinians in Gaza being carried out by Israel. The hunger strike was launched after students with the group Hunger Strikers for Palestine sent a letter to the Yale president Savoy on Wednesday demanding that the university divest from its investments in companies providing Israel with military technology. Quote, "In the total non-response of any kind from the institution we are speaking to, the final thing we can do is put our life on the line, our health and our well-being." Well, no response for the mainstream media either on this, except for Fox News, which sort of suggested the students had access to food if they wanted it and, you know, were lying about the fast, essentially. But I don't think our media wants this story to spread. There are tens of thousands of college students looking for something more powerful as we watch the children of Gaza starve to death. The second story is from Truth Out. In reality, the Biden administration has the power to stop Israel's offensive in Gaza in its tracks. Although Congress authorizes military aid, the President has the authority under the Arms Export Control Act to withhold, or threaten to withhold, the military aid when the recipient nation violates U.S. or international law. In terms of the international legal system, Israel is currently violating the Fourth Geneva Convention regarding the treatment of civilians in wartime, among a number of other statutes, and it's violating the UN Security Council Resolution 2728, which demands an immediate temporary ceasefire. Israel is also in violation of Section 502B of the 1961 Foreign Assistance Act, which prohibits aid to countries that prevent access to humanitarian relief supplies, and the 1999 Leahy Amendment, which prohibits funding foreign security forces engaged in the commission of gross violations of human rights. And finally, Biden's own National Security Memorandum 20, which requires U.S. security partners to provide written assurance that they will use U.S. military assistance in accordance with international law and facilitate humanitarian aid. Instead, Biden has utilized emergency powers to bypass public and congressional oversight in providing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arms from U.S. stockpiles overseas, including Hellfire missiles, bunker-busting bombs, which have had a devastating impact on Gaza's civilian population. At the end of March, his administration approved billions of dollars worth of additional bombs and fighter jets to Netanyahu's forces.
This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So we had hoped to provide more audio from the student rally at the State Capitol. Unfortunately, wasn't good enough quality to do that, so we tapped into Fred Nagel's report on the Gaza situation. I will note this Friday at 4 p.m. at the State Capitol, Fridays for Future, Greta Thunberg's inspired group, will be holding an early Earth Day event, and they are particularly making the connection between the need to divest from fossil fuels and the need to get the state controller to also divest from Israel. But for those of you just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from This Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content on social media, for instance. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
Experiencing a total solar eclipse can be hard to put into words, but I took along my recorder and brought you along my experience of going to Dead Creek Nature Preserve in Vermont. Standing on this bird overlook over a marshy area in the Dead Creek Wildlife Preserve. I drove up here with my dad, who lives in Columbia County. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name's Kevin Hickey.
All right, so we are listening to the birds. We're hearing at least 14, I think we've counted. And we are looking up at the sun, which has now been half covered by the moon. Is that right?
I'd say at the moment it's about a third covered. And we can already feel that it's getting cooler. There were some frogs that started singing, and then they stopped. The birds are still singing, particularly the song sparrow. But eventually the birds should all go quiet, and probably the frogs and peepers will start to sing. And it should get even colder and obviously darker. And maybe the wind will pick up as the warm and dark air needs to recirculate and stabilize.
Hi, I'm Jan Fraga, and I'm a retired teacher who's been volunteering here at Dead Creek Visitor Center for the last 7 years. Dead Creek is about 3,000 acres of wetlands with a series of 13 dams that can control the levels of the wetlands. It's been a conservation since the 1950s. And it's just east of Lake Champlain and west of Green Mountain, so it's very rich in both wildlife and in plant life.
So as we're standing here, the parking lot is getting more and more full as people are coming in to be in the zone of totality for the solar eclipse today. Why is a nature preserve a great place to view this?
People are coming here, are excited about what we have here. Plants, animals, birds flying over. I saw some geese flying over already this morning. So it's a good place with people of your own kind. If you love this, this is a great place to be.
My name's Betty Jakeway.
And Nelson Jakeway.
And where are you coming from to view the total solar eclipse?
Tynemouth, Vermont, which is about an hour south of here.
An hour south, so that is just out of the total zone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we had to drive north.
Is this your first time viewing an eclipse?
You figured we had...
We saw a partial eclipse back in the 70s, and I remember the chickens going into roost.
Which is great, yeah.
In the afternoon.
So we're here with a lookout right above a marsh. So are you expecting something similar with all the animals going silent?
Well, it's supposed to be, yeah. Yeah, the birds are supposed to be quiet, yeah. Yeah.
Did you come to this spot specifically for that experience?
No, we had no idea where we were going to end up. We might have been on the side of the road, but we just decided we wanted the full eclipse. So, and we saw this, woodcock viewing area, mob across the road, and you guys the only ones here.
Yeah, we found a nice secretive spot off the road somehow. And you were telling me earlier that you were working with young people earlier.
Yeah.
And they had made an eclipse song. What was that experience like?
We used Here Comes the Sun, George Harrison's song. But they put their words to it. Yeah.
Which were?
Well, here comes eclipse. And then we talked about the birds and this dog. And it's once in a lifetime. And things like that.
Hey, how are you?
Hi. Do you mind if I ask questions about the experience here?
Absolutely not.
All right, so you've got a pretty nice setup here. What are you looking through over here?
Looking over the iPhone. Through the small hole in a binocular.
So it's an iPhone on a tripod looking through binoculars with a photo filter.
Mm-hmm.
And how does it look?
Not bad at all.
Could you introduce yourself? Your name?
Vladimir, I'm from San Diego, actually.
You're from San Diego,
so you... I'm from San Diego, yes. I have family in Albany. We stayed in Albany, but yeah. We did drive from Saratoga Springs.
And what's your name?
Sergey Weiss. So, I'm in Saratoga Springs, yes.
And with this fancy setup, are you a photographer?
No. Amateur.
Amateur. Yes. Are you excited?
Yeah, of course. We are, but most important for me to take the shot. But it's hard to do with this setup.
It is very hard.
Yeah, with this setup. I'm not professional, that's why. I'm saying it's not so easy.
I'm David, and I'm a performer and dancer, and we came here from New York City.
Great. And you're here with a group of three other people?
Yeah, three other people. My partner and friends that we kind of spontaneously met.
I'm Jennifer.
I'm Iki.
I'm Zoe.
So why come all this way from New York for the eclipse?
I was going up anyway to do a residency, and then I knew about the eclipse, and then I think the buzz around people I was staying with, we were talking about it, and it became something special, and as dancers, we were thinking about doing like a dance score to honor it, because it happens so rarely, and then me and a friend read this essay by Annie Dillard, part of it, and we were already kind of in 99% totality, but in the essay she says that it's not the same at all. It's like you haven't seen an eclipse if you haven't been in a total eclipse. And then I met Iki and Jennifer, and they were driving up anyway, and they just let us come with them, which was so special. So I'm so glad we get to experience this. I don't have a strong relationship to the moon, and it's so easy to ignore all the time, I'm just excited to be present where you can't ignore it. It's like so, I have no idea what to expect, and I'm just excited to be here. Yeah.
Look at that.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Oh, now it's trying to break out.
So can you describe this moment? Wow. Well, what color is the world right now? Whoa! Our shadows are reappearing. We just came out of the total. Wow.
You can hear all people yelling all around us and cheering.
Somebody's watching from an airplane, I can hear. That was worth the trip.
Oof. That was spectacular with the corona, everything really dark, a little bit of light in the clouds, the sky looks like it's polarized, and our shadows completely disappearing.
And now they're reappearing, and it feels maybe because our pupils have adjusted to the darkness, but so silvery, right?
Yes, it does somehow look different than before, even though it must be the same. So the birds did not completely go silent. They definitely got much quieter, but a couple of them still were calling. And suddenly, about 3 minutes before the total eclipse, all sorts of birds were flying around. Ducks and some small bird I wasn't able to identify. So there seemed to be some confusion amongst the birds about where to go and what to do. And the eclipse with the corona was really just, you couldn't stop looking at it.
Wasn't that the fastest sunset ever?
Yeah, the fastest sunset. For me, it felt very silvery. Did it feel like a silver?
During the eclipse, yes. But still, now it is still a little bit more polarized.
Yeah.
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 the lights are more, the landscape are more polarized.
She was right. She was right.
So you said the poem was right?
Yeah. The story, she said, if you haven't seen a total eclipse, you haven't seen an eclipse. And that seeing a partial eclipse is like kissing a man, and and seeing a total eclipse is like marrying one. Yeah. Which is a weird...
I'm really glad I got married.
But I was like, we wouldn't have seen that. We would have seen everything right up, but we wouldn't have seen... And I'm shocked that... Just like the brightness, like, you, as soon as it came back out, even the tiniest bit, it's too bright to look at. And right now, it's only like 5%, 6% of the sun, and it's... I wouldn't be able to tell. Like, it was magical. It was like... I forgot, yeah. I was like laughing, and it was just so beautiful. Like, it's, I don't know how you felt. There was like so much more. There's colors like pink, a pink dot.
Right.
And then the sunset all around.
Yeah. Like a halo or something.
I'm like, this, I could do this once a day. You know, just, this was, just felt serene. Yeah.
So that was Sina Basilihicky. Following, chasing the total eclipse, my son went up to the Adirondack Mountains outside of Soluble Chasm and said at the top of the mountain on one side it was the sunset, and the other side it was the sunrise at the same time, and that was quite amazing. So we'll see you all next time on that total eclipse.
And we finish our show with Andrea Cunliffe's story around Beethoven, live in concert, an original rock musical about the epic, tragic life of Ludwig von Beethoven. She talks with creator Jad Jacob, producer Ian McQueen, and director M. Hausman about the production.
Beethoven, live in concert, written by Jad Jacob, writer, actor, and composer of this. Ian McQueen, the executive producer.
Nice to be with you
Thank
as well.
Thank you for having us.
Ian, how did the two of you put this production together?
I think it was just over 2 years ago and got connected through a mutual friend as someone who was into producing new works. And so Jad had reached out to him to see if he might be interested. He was busy with some other projects and he very kindly recommended me. Fort Salem Theater, still fairly new. They had been sort of a summer stock theater for a while, doing a lot of new works and mostly plays. And so the artistic director of this theater, Kyle West, and his husband, Jared, purchased the theater. We had known them to have developed a couple sort of workshops and concerts of new works in the past. And just from being a theater that's fairly local to Niskayuna, where Jad grew up doing theater, a lot of people from his community who had stayed up here, who were still part of the theater scene in and around here, who either knew of Fort Salem Theater or had come and performed here. We did a concert of the show in May of 2023 that went incredibly well, was really well received, and just was generating a lot of excitement for people who came and wanted to hear more of the show. And then we sort of put together a pitch deck to send to theaters of just say, hey, do you have room in your season to help develop an upcoming new musical? And Fort Salem was eager and willing. They said yes. And yeah, we're feeling incredibly lucky to be here.
Jed, you've come up with this idea to do, well, I guess it's a rock musical with Beethoven?
Yeah. I grew up performing around the Capital Region. I did performances at SLOC, and, you know, I went to Niskayuna High School and all the sort of local worlds of Park Playhouse and Proctor's and all that fun stuff. But this is sort of the first time I've really endeavored to, like, complete a full musical. It came from a variety of inspirations. I mean, rock music and classical music have always been huge parts of my life. I grew up playing classical piano, so I remember learning, like, the Ode to Joy when I was 3 or 4 years old, and that's sort of always been something that's carried with me. But I also used to watch a lot of classic rock music videos, like Queen and Michael Jackson and even, like, the Scorpions and Peter Gabriel and all that stuff, and I felt that they were both equally passionate and inspiring and epic. You know, I never distinguished them as like, oh, like rock is really cool and then classical is like slow and boring and you listen on the radio or whatever. I never had that sense. I was a freshman in college and I just kind of stumbled on Beethoven's life story. I was researching him for another project, and then I just sort of dug deeper than I was intending to, and I was so taken aback by how inspiring his story was. I mean, I know we all know the sort of basic plot points of his life, perhaps that he went deaf and he wrote the Ode to Joy, and maybe that's kind of where most people fall. And I was shocked to find how relatable his story was, not just as an artist, but as somebody who was really, you know, struggling in the world that he grew up in and felt like he had a lot of things that he wanted to say, but didn't really know how to say them. He grew up in a very politically charged time, and he had a lot of trouble distinguishing himself from composers like Mozart and Haydn who came before him. And I drew a lot of connections from that to the sort of rock and roll revolution of the 60s and 70s, where you have people like Elton John or Little Richard or even Elvis coming in, you know, after this era of like the Beatles and doo-wop and Bobby Darin and Frank Sinatra and all this stuff. There's sort of this huge wave of not just counterculture, but also like political counterculture that seeped into the music in America and the West and the world in general. And I felt that his story really, really had so many parallels to that world. He was very sort of anti-establishment. He kind of grew up on the ideas of the American Revolution, of the French Revolution, of the Enlightenment. And he grew up in a society where, you know, people were sort of stuck to their social class based on their wealth and their marital status and if they were a part of the aristocracy or not. And, you know, he was sort of this out of town nobody, and he didn't have a lot of money, and that presented a lot of barriers to him. And so I felt that the language that he would speak today would be rock and roll. So the concept of this show is that we sort of took Beethoven and made him a contemporary rock star, where he's existing in this world that's similar to the 60s, of a little bit of emotional or social repression of that time, where there's a sort of conformist ideals for everybody. And, you know, Mozart's there and Haydn's there, and they're all sort of stiff and they've got their ties on, and there's a specific way that classical music should be run. And Beethoven shows up, and instead of this sort of 50-year-old angry man with the white hair that we all know, he's sort of a 20-something rebellious guy in a jean jacket and cool sunglasses. And he sort of throws this new sound out into the world of Vienna and basically changes the world of music. So it's been super exciting kind of recontextualizing that story. And hopefully people will really connect with his journey.
Did you combine some of his work? Did you turn it into rock and roll?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's all original music. There's about 30 songs on the show right now. It's all original, mostly rock style musical theater. But because we're following chronological order of his life, we get to infuse a lot of those moments of his familiar works. So, you know, things like the Moonlight Sonata or the Fur Elise or the Fifth Symphony or the Ninth Symphony, you will hear those. And even if you don't know that you know them, you will know them and you'll go, oh yeah, I know that melody. And we just had our band in last weekend. So one of the things we are doing with the arrangements is, for example, with the Fifth Symphony, instead of violins, we're throwing that into the electrical guitar and we're adding drums onto it. And you will be surprised how easily it fits. It feels like the right sound for that kind of piece. And there's sort of the more obvious notes there. And then there's a lot of deep cuts where if you're really intense classical music fan, you will pick up on little motifs here and there that I threw in just for fun.
And joining us is M. Hausman, the director. I'm excited because you're all smiling, so this is good sign. M. Hausman, the director.
We all definitely can feel what a special show that Jen has written. Consider myself to be a director of new works. That's sort of my bread and butter. I have a lot of experience with that. But I can't say I've ever worked on something quite at this scale, right? It's a huge, huge project. It's a beast of a show. And every piece of the show is so important to telling the story that Jad has so beautifully laid out. For months, Jad and I would meet up in his apartment and just talk through the book and the staging and the intentions behind the characters, and lots of preparation, lots of careful planning. These actors have done a really marvelous job at just hopping right on in. You know, we did music for about a week, and then we staged for about 2 weeks. And this week is our final week, and we're in tech just to get into performances.
Jad, did you decide to cast yourself or not?
I mean, it came from a variety of reasons. Initially, that was not my intention. Actually, initially, there were other characters in the show that I was interested in playing, but one of the necessities is we needed somebody that could play the piano for this role. So that was one of the initial limitations. You know, I've been working on this project for 6-7 years now. So the first maybe 4 or 5 years were just me going, oh yeah, I'll do it for the demo and I'll do this and I'll do that and I'll play the piano too and whatever. As an actor who became a writer, I've always written from the perspective of actors, and like I always like to write dialogue and story from something that would be exciting to portray and like really fun to act out. And I think in doing that, I did get very attached to the character, and it became something so personal to me. It just became inevitably something where the road headed towards me at Fort Salem playing this role. It's been a really cool process working with M because, you know, as I said, for the first 5-6 years, it was just sort of me alone at my keyboard writing everything out. And then suddenly I'm not the creator anymore. I'm an actor on stage, and I don't know what I look like. I don't know if I'm doing it well. And M is kind of throwing ideas at me and notes. And it's been so exciting to have somebody to lean on in that process and trust. Because I think with a project so large and personal, it can be really scary to like expand it out to other people. And that's been one of the things I'm finding is like loosening my grip on the production has been such an incredible experience, because it's let so many other people in to like put their own fingerprints on, you know, whether it's the music or the arrangements or the producing or costumes or whatever it is. And being able to do that as an actor with M has been super cool, because I feel like they've pulled things out of the character that like I didn't necessarily know were there, or like I wouldn't have necessarily thought about. So it's been really cool growing the script into something that I feel like I can see where each person has left their mark.
Em, tell me, how is the casting going? How many people and where are they from? And
For Fort Salem, we've got a really amazing cast. Few people from the Salem community, majorly from the Albany areas. And then we also, of course, have Jad. And then we have one New York City-based actress. Her name is Sarah Beth Pfeiffer. She's been on Broadway. She's got a really amazing resume, and she's so gifted. And we're very fortunate to have her coming in to play our female lead. So we have Sarah Beth and Jad coming from the city, and then everybody else is locals. The local community is just doing an amazing job at keeping up with the pace and being like a great team to each other and helping each other find their own footing as we, you know, navigate this crazy, crazy show.
So Ian is the producer. What do you think? Where is this production going to go?
Oh my gosh. From the moment I heard the music, like there are a lot of people who've like written musicals, and that's all well and good, but like there's really something like special about this one. And you can feel like the time and the care that's been put into each song and into every scene and just into making it sound distinct and purposeful. And also this music is excellent. People need to hear it right now. And we've said this a couple times this week working with Sarah Beth. It's lovely to have the buy-in from people who do this professionally and are working in the industry to take the time out of their day and not only do this, but want to do it and really want to do it justice and feel really invested. I mean, I absolutely think this project has legs for Broadway. Like there's no question. What's sort of so much fun about this show is, you know, with the conceit being this mix of classical and rock.
And so that was Beethoven live in concert. And we'll be at the Fort Salem Theater this weekend, April 19th to 21st.
And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunley, our engineer. It's been the wonderful Joan Eason. We want to thank all the volunteers who made tonight's episode possible, including Andrea Cunliffe, who did the Beethoven segment, and Fred Nagel. Thanks to you, our listeners, for making this all worthwhile.